In his book, Disintegration, The Splintering of Black America, Eugene Robinson says that black immigrants who have come to the United States in the past four decades have not come to an America that trains fire hoses on black people, but have come instead to a country that practices affirmative action. I remember the first America, and I'm sure many of you do as well. I remember watching the nightly news and seeing the fire hoses and the dogs and the nightsticks and the bombings and the brutality. And I remember Ruby being walked to school and James Meredith being escorted into Ole Miss and the nine students in Little Rock surrounded by the National Guard as they entered Central High School. Seeing those federal marshals and the National Guard members protect those young people from riotous crowds and brutal police and angry governors is the reason I will always, always be a liberal Democrat, because I believe that sometimes you need the power and the authority of the federal government to step in and do the right thing. So much has changed in these past 50 years. Robinson describes some of the changes in the black community. He writes, "There was a time when there were agreed upon black leaders, when there was a clear black agenda, when we could talk confidently about the state of black America, but not anymore. Not after decades of desegregation, affirmative action, and urban decay. Not after globalization decimating the working class and trickle-down economics sorted the nation into winners and losers. Not after the biggest wave of black immigration from Africa and the Caribbean since slavery. Not after most people ceased to even notice or care when a black man and a white woman walked down the street hand in hand. These are among the forces and trends that have had the unintended consequence of tearing black America to pieces. Barack Obama's election as the first African-American president seemed to come out of nowhere, but it was the result of a transformation that's been unfolding for decades. With implications both hopeful and dispiriting, black America has undergone a process of disintegration. So now instead of one black America, there are four, and more, we lead separate lives." Growing up in Northern Virginia, I lived in a segregated state. There were separate schools and separate waiting rooms and separate restaurants, separate drinking fountains, separate everything. But because I was white, I was, of course, never on the receiving end of the injustice of that separate but unequal system. And I can't help but think today, as President Obama is being sworn in for the second time, how that system of segregation I once knew could never, ever have imagined such a thing, and how far we have come, and how good it is. In those days, and in that world, there really were only two races. You were black or you were white. And today, that is no longer true. You may have seen the New York Times article some time ago describing the multi and biracial student association at the University of Maryland. Several members of the group had been discussing President Obama's racial identity and debating whether he was the first black president or the first multiracial president. The students took their questions to the campus chapter of the NAACP. One student's immediate response was, "He's black, it's the one drop rule." Another said, "To say that would be denying his whole identity." A third student said, "Stop trying to take away our black president." And a fourth said, "To identify him as black only was offensive to her as a multiracial person because she wanted all of her racial identity acknowledged." The president of the school's multi and biracial association, Michelle Lopez Mullins, who is Chinese and Peruvian on one side and white and Native American on the other, said she just wants race not to matter. And when she was asked what she indicates on forms like the census, what her race is, she says, it depends on the day. Eugene Robinson thinks we are moving closer to a day when race won't matter. Robinson is at least my age because he also grew up in the time of segregation, but in the deeply segregated South, and he knew firsthand what it meant to be on the receiving end of it. By anyone's standards, as a Pulitzer Prize recipient, a London bureau chief for the Washington Post, well-known author and columnist, Eugene Robinson has made it. And yet he says, no matter how completely and unambiguously I feel a part of the American system, I know that this system despised my parents and my parents' parents. It's knowledge that doesn't affect the way I go about my day-to-day life, but it is always there. I tell you this so that you know, as I share his assessment of Black America today, that he understands racism in this country because he has lived in it and through it, and he has seen the changes. There was a time, he says, when you could speak of Black America and know you met one group, because even though the phrase represented a great diversity of people spread from one end of the country to the other, there was a sense of solidarity that came with being African American. And that solidarity came from being uniformly held back, uniformly oppressed, having agreed upon Black leaders and sharing a unified Black agenda. But he says, not anymore. The first chapter of his book is entitled, Black America Doesn't Live Here Anymore. And he maintains it's because Black America has undergone this process of disintegration. Today, he says, there are four distinct Black Americas. First, there's the mainstream middle class. Next, what he calls the abandoned minority, mired in poverty and dysfunction. Third, the elite transcendent group with such power, influence, and wealth, they're all but untouchable. And finally, the fourth group, made up of two emergent groups, people of mixed race, like students featured in the Times article, and recent Black immigrants, the majority from Africa. These four categories of Black Americans are, says Robinson, increasingly distinct and separated by demography, geography, and psychology. They have different mindsets, different hopes and fears and dreams, and they lead separate lives. Well, how did this happen? Obviously, when the civil rights laws opened doors for opportunities that hadn't existed before in just about every aspect of life, the workplace and education and housing and lifestyle and politics, people took those opportunities and life changed. Robinson uses the example of saying that if you found yourself among a representative group of an all-Black crowd 40 years ago, you could assume that about half of the people in that group were poor and not well-educated. Today, if you found yourself in a representative group of Black adults, 4 out of 5 would be solidly middle class. He also says it's interesting that we don't hear a lot about the Black middle class majority. We hear about transcendent stars like Colin Powell, and we hear about the abandoned poor like the abandoned poor, but he says the middle class rarely makes the news. In part, that has to be because when you're middle class, who has time to make the news when you're driving kids to school and shoveling snow and paying bills and trying to buy a house or pay a mortgage? But he says it's more than that. There is an invisibility about the Black middle class that he says is a remnant of racism. There are, he says, Black professors who specialize in international relations, but they're not the ones reporters call on. There are Black scuba diving clubs that explore the coast of the Great Barrier Reef, but their members aren't the ones who are asked about coral. But he says, if you want to see the black middle class, you can go to a homecoming game at a black college, or go to Prince George's County in Maryland, where almost 70% of the residents are black, and the median income is just under $70,000. Or go to Mitchellville, an almost all black town, where the average house is $500,000, or of course go to any black church. Another way of looking at the solvency of the black middle class is to compare their aggregate purchasing power, which is almost $100 billion. If America's black middle class were a sovereign nation, it would have the 17th largest economy in the world. All of this, says Robinson, has happened in the past 40 years. That's just two generations. It would, he says, make Horatio Alger proud. On either side, or more accurately, at either end of the middle class spectrum, are the newly transcendent, the super rich and powerful, and the chronically poor. The super group includes people like the Obamas and Tiger Woods, Oprah, Vernon Jordan, Magic Johnson, Denzel Washington, Colin Powell, and our own governor. How do they get their wealth, their power, their influence, their household name status? Well, the same way everyone else does who gets to the top, through talent and incredibly hard work. If the chapter on the transcendent group was the shortest, the chapter on the abandoned poor is the most somber. Inevitably, every change brings gains, and that same change also brings losses. When opportunities opened, and at least by law, black Americans were able to choose where they lived and where they worked, the cohesion of the black community began a slow process of erosion. With real integration back in the 60s, no longer was there a need for black businesses or theaters or clubs or facilities or neighborhoods. This change meant that places like U Street in Washington, which had been a mecca of black culture, a gathering spot for years for Washington's black community, changed as people moved out of the city and away from exclusively black neighborhoods. And since there is no longer a need for black jazz clubs or black theaters or black neighborhoods, when African Americans could go anywhere, what had been a solid, stable, and economically diverse and relatively prosperous inner city neighborhood began to slowly and steadily decline. Several years ago, I flew to Washington to attend a UU Service Committee 3-day conference. It was held at a black hotel in Southeast Washington, and when I gave the cab driver the address, he was African American, he said, you don't want to go there. He said, that's a bad neighborhood. Well, that's where I'm going, I said, so let's go. And he was right. Southeast Washington, of course, is a bad neighborhood. But the hotel was charming, and the owner thanked us for staying there, and he said, you know, even all black groups come to Washington, and they don't stay here. They stay at the Sheraton, or they stay at the Hilton on Connecticut Avenue. And that night, the president of Howard University came as our featured speaker, and he talked to us about what that neighborhood had been like when he was growing up as a boy. He described how the houses looked and all of the businesses and stores and theaters, and he talked about the close community feeling that had been there. He said, you can't imagine what a thriving community this area was only 30 years ago, and now look at it. Robinson says that people who had the means to take advantage of the post-civil rights opportunities took them, and for those who, for whatever reason, couldn't, were left behind. Of course, the other major factor that contributes to keeping the disadvantaged poor is the obvious one, which is lack of jobs. When industry left cities decades ago, low-skilled and entry-level jobs left the city too. It gets harder and harder to see the abandoned poor, Robinson says, because they're increasingly pushed out to the margins of society and becoming even more isolated from the mainstream, from both black and white middle class. Last month, I was in Harlem spending the night with my cousin and her husband in their new three-bedroom condominium with a magnificent view of St. John the Divine Church. And I asked them about the other people in the building, and they said, oh, it's wonderful. It's like a small United Nations here. And I wondered, what happened to the people who used to live here, the people who couldn't afford to buy a condominium once that building was refurbished? Eugene Robinson believes the government needs to create a Marshall Plan as an intervention to give the abandoned poor an opportunity to break out of poverty, but he says it will be a hard sell. I guess we can forgive his cynicism when he says that for some inexplicable reason, it's easier to convince Americans to spend billions of dollars for nation building in faraway places like Iraq and Afghanistan than it is to fund comparable efforts here at home. Finally, we come to the fourth category called the emergent groups, those of mixed race heritage and the new black immigrants. The growing numbers of people who are mixed race are, as the Times article indicated, not a unified group in terms of how they see their own identity. You remember one young woman didn't care, another wanted every part of her racial makeup identified, and yet another wanted to claim just one identity. President Obama falls into a double emergent group because he is both part of the new wave of immigrants as his African father, and he is also mixed race. Robinson notes that President Obama chooses to identify himself far more often as an African American than he does as a mixed race person. The phenomena of both recent black immigrants and people of mixed race backgrounds raise interesting questions about race today. For instance, Robinson says, while President Obama and I are both black, that because President Obama is biracial, his relationship with white America is different than mine. Even if you self-identify as just one race, as he does, President Obama, the reality is that he was lovingly rocked to sleep each night by a white mother, and he was raised by white grandparents, which means he can never really see white America as other than he is, because that's what he is too. There's some interesting facts about this new wave of black immigrants from Africa and the Caribbean. First, this is fascinating, I think. One out of every four black individuals in Massachusetts is foreign-born. Second, African immigrants are the best educated immigrants in the country today, better educated than Asians, Europeans, or any other regional group. And black immigrant students have a higher rate of overall college attendance than do American white or black students, and a 9.2% of immigrant black students attend Ivy League schools compared to 7.3% of white students. A question not even being addressed that both emergent groups raise is whether immigrant and biracial African Americans have the same sense of historical injury as other black Americans, and if they don't, does it matter? Soon there will be more African Americans who had no experience of Jim Crow or the civil rights years than there will be those who once lived under it. And I think the most interesting fact of all is that within 35 years, the prediction is there will be no one racial or ethnic majority in the United States. And that, we can only believe, will be good for us all. So I close with the words of African-American UU minister, Reverend Mark Morrison Reed, in which he describes the task of religious community. The central task of religious community is to unveil the bonds that bind each to all. It is the church that assures us that we are not struggling for justice on our own. Alone, our vision is too narrow to see all that must be seen, our strength too limited to do all that must be done. Together, our vision widens, and together, our strength is renewed. May it be so.